coming to Plush.
Yeah.
I think it's $15. Get yourself into Plush. Rico Uno is going to be playing alongside Headspin. Biz Markie is going to be performing. And legendary sneaker / graffiti artists. Futura, I think, and some other people are going to be there. So if you're up on your sneaker game and you love that kind of stuff, make sure you get down to Plush tonight. It's $15. And it should be a good show. Also Saturday, can't forget to mention DJ Secco is having his Big Up Saturday premiere. That's also a Plush.
Yeah.
If you know him, hit him up for guest list.
Yeah, that'll be good on Saturday.
Should be a good night, yeah. So there you go. You're all lined up for the next 3 days. No excuse not to party. But be sure to hit up the Balmoral tomorrow night and Plush on Saturday. Support local artists tonight as well. That's about it, Cody. We're done. Hope it's still sunny.
Yeah, 5 o'clock, yeah.
No.
Let's get the hell out of here.
All right, we're out. Peace.
Yes, you're looking for a bad time. That's what you're after. You're a dirty flirt. You want it bad, and you don't care who you get it from because you have no self-respect, and that gets you off, doesn't it?
Oh. Stewie! Bad boy, that's mommy's makeup.
Make any joke you want. You know I look good.
Zoom a little, zoom in a rocket ship. Off we go on a trip. Heading for the moon at a rocket clip. We're gonna zoom, zoom, rocket. Zoom a little, zoom, now we're almost free from the Earth's gravity. Zooming to the moon at terrific speed because there is no friction. Soon we'll see if the moon is made out of green cheese. Ha, 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 ha. Zoom, we're here at the moon. Let's see what the moon is like.
Hey everyone, and welcome to my science project for another week. This week's show is inspired by a holiday we had just last week, which would be the day of the Valentine. Valentine's Day, of course, holiday of love and cards and candy. And did I mention cards? Yes, the card industry's most celebrated Valentine's Day. It perks up our economy every February. But hey, it's a great excuse to treat yourself to some fine quality chocolate and maybe sneak in a dinner out with someone who you love or care for or just like hanging out with. And so, inspired by all of these happy vibes floating through the air, I thought that it would be fun and entertaining for everyone if I did a show that delved into the science of attraction, love, and, of course, sex, including why incest may actually be advantageous, not just convenient. The science of osculation and what it can tell you on a first date. We'll look at the question, can you judge a man's sperm by his cover? And we'll talk a bit about the benefits of asexuality. Of course, there's science news, there's science music, there's all kinds of good stuff to come. I thought we'd start with some unrelated to love science tidbits. Some kind of weird stuff that's just cropped up that I thought was worth a mention. The first item being a paper I came across. I subscribed to various table of contents from various journals or various publishers. And so one of these is, let's say, biology, and another is evolution. So I get some kind of interesting things coming through on these alerts, these e-alerts. And there's a couple of journals out there that I find particularly entertaining because they deal with scientific issues I would never have thought of. And they're basically focused on produce. For example, in the journal Post-Harvest Biology and Technology, their recent volume, volume 48 of this year, features a paper entitled Three-Point Bending, an Alternative Method to Measure Tensile Properties in Fruit and Vegetables. Basically, they're doing stress tests on veggies. So I had to look at this. I had to check this thing out. And you can check it out, too, if you've got access to Post-Harvest Biology and Technology. It's volume 48, starting on page 63. Pitts et al., Pitts, Davis, and Cavalieri. Apparently, firmness is a key factor in consumer acceptance of fruit. It's measured as an indicator of maturity, and in many governmental jurisdictions, firmness is a part of legislation governing shipment of fresh fruit. With firmness playing such an important role in fruit and veggie quality, it's ironic that tissue mechanics, which govern firmness, are not well understood. Without this knowledge, development of destructive or non-destructive instruments to measure fruit firmness is hampered. Poorly understood tissue mechanics also leaves a potential for disagreement over the definition of firmness and subsequent disagreement about the firmness of a shipment of fruit. So basically there is being done scientific research to test how to test fruit firmness. Things you don't know. The next item is to do with, well, I guess, do clothes make the man or the woman? There's some new technology that was reported in the BBC just in the last week, 13th of February, that talks about, quote-unquote, power dressing. Now, not power dressing in terms of ambition, per se, but power dressing in terms of fabric that can actually generate energy. Scientists in the United States have developed novel brush-like fibers that generate electrical energy for movement, kind of in the same vein as having a self-winding watch that you wear and that winds as you walk, according to your movement. Weaving these fibers into a material could allow designers to create smart clothes, which harness body movement to power portable electronic gadgets like your MP3 player. So as you walk, you're powering up your music. Writing in the journal Nature, the team say that the materials could also be used in tents or other structures to harness wind energy. So essentially anything that makes the fabric move and these fibers rub together. The nanogenerators, as the technology is known, consist of pairs of fibers that look similar to tiny bendable bottle brushes. So, you know, the wire stems with kind of plasticky tips at the end that you can use to clean small little bottles. At the core of each fiber is a Kevlar stock. Basically, on the surface, the scientists grow crystals called nanowires. Each wire is 30 to 50 nanometers, or billionths of a meter, in length, and is made of zinc oxide. And these wires are grown in solution on this Kevlar stock. One of the bristled fibers is also dipped in gold to act as an electrode. When the pair is scrubbed together, they create a small amount of electrical energy, i.e. via your movement. Scientists also say that if they can optimize the design, they can get up to 80 milliwatts per square meter of fabric that could potentially power an MP3 player. Now, someone who's unaffiliated with the research, Professor George Stelios of Harriet Watt University, who works on smart flexible materials, is a little skeptical. He thinks that anybody wearing the fibers would have to move very fast or would have to wear a lot of fabric. But, I mean, hey, let's say that you decide you want to go for a jog. It could still be powering up your music, per se. The next item is about tattoos. You might not think that tattoos are particularly scientific, but apparently scientists in Germany would disagree with you. They say that tattoos could be the ideal way of delivering vaccines to the body. So, like we need another reason to fear vaccination. Instead of one needle, you get a whole bunch of fast needles in a short space of time. And basically that's sort of the gist of this research. The tests were actually done on mice, and the reason that they did this was because certain vaccines, such as therapeutic vaccines in humans to treat some cancers, have often failed to produce an expected immune response when delivered using a classical injection technique. The researchers in Germany say that the rapidly vibrating tattoo needle could be a useful way of delivering such vaccines under the skin, because the greater, and this is where it gets again kind of unappealing, but the greater damage to the body caused by the tattoo needle seems to produce more antibodies. And in these mice that were tattooed with the vaccine, they had 16 times more antibodies than a simple injection into the muscle tissue. And so the success of the vaccination is measured by the level of antibodies. So 16 times more antibodies indicates a much stronger immune response. The scientists say that the tattoo needles would never be suitable for preventative vaccines such as measles in kids, because the pain would be too great. They say that in addition to therapeutic vaccines in adult humans, there may be a role for the technique in the routine vaccination of animals. A sidebar to this is that if you're actually interested in some pretty cool science tattoos, there is a website that you can visit. It's very impressive, I must say. If you Google science tattoos, it, as of yesterday, was the second hit from the top. It's a Flickr website put up by a fellow named Carl Zimmer. And it's just a whole suite of really interesting science-related tattoos. Who knows, maybe one day you can get some ink and a vaccination at the same time. Here is an example of science making the world a better place. It might be a small thing, but I think it's an important thing. Researchers from the University of Sheffield took the novel and yet somehow blatantly obvious approach of interviewing 255 hospitalized kids in England to ask them if they liked clowns. These kids were aged between 4 and 16 years, and none of the 255 kids interviewed liked clowns. In fact, according to the research which was published in the magazine Nursing Standard, and this story goes back to mid-January of this year, some of these kids found clowns frightening and unknowable. End quote. Others call them scary and kind of creepy. I have yet to meet a person who actually likes clowns. And it's weird that even because adults admit that they don't like clowns, they still go and stick clown images up in kids' wards and hospitals. And apparently none of these kids like the clowns. So, the researchers are creating a guide to kid-friendlier hospital environments. You can check out their suggestions, which include characters from Disney cartoons and Warner Brothers cartoons and blah, blah, blah. The website is tinyurl.com. That's tinyurl.com/YPZOFX. There you go. It's a scientific fact. No one likes clowns. If you're a clown, maybe you should look for a different line of work. So getting back to our theme of love and science of love, let's face it, kids, all roads lead to this.
Ooh, ah, ooh, ah.
And we're back. You're listening to My Science Project on CITR 101.9 FM. This is the Valentine's Day show, the science of all things love and attraction and sex. And at the top of the show, I mentioned we'd talk about a report of the genetic benefits of asexuality. And asexuality in this case doesn't mean, for example, in a human context where an individual is simply uninterested in sex, which is an interesting sidebar. Apparently the artist Edward Gorey was a self-identified asexual. But in this context, asexuality refers to a lack of reproduction through sexual means. So in other words, there is no sexual recombination of genes. There instead is a cloning of sorts of an individual organism, usually single-celled or an invertebrate organism that does something like budding off a piece of itself, producing and releasing spores that then develop, or developing another part of itself through a fragment that then breaks off and goes on to create a daughter organism that is basically genetically identical to its parent because there's been no swappage of genes like you'd have in a sexual reproductive organism like you and I. Now, meiosis is the thing that's really important here, and this is a bit of biology 101 for everybody. If you don't remember, meiosis is essential for sexual reproduction. There's mitosis and meiosis. Meiosis involves two rounds of cell division that produces four cells. Each of these four daughter cells has one complete set of chromosomes or half the genetic content of the original cell. So in other words, each cell on its own cannot a child make, but when combined with another cell with half of the chromosomal content, they go on to create viable offspring. So when each parent cell with half of the chromosomes comes together, at this point meiosis has already done one randomization step, which is the point at which the genetic content is originally split into two parts. There's another randomization event that happens when these two cells come together. And this is when chromosomes do what's called crossing over, which means that they can swap parts of their DNA, making new genetic combinations. So we get genetic recombination when the cells split into two, and then we can also get different genetic recombination when the cells come back together. So asexual organisms don't do this. And this means that they typically aren't that successful as a group and have typically gone extinct within about a million years because the lack of genetic exchange doesn't allow for the removal of bad mutations or for the sharing of good mutations. But a class of aquatic invertebrates called bdelloid rotifers have persisted for 35 to 40 million years, earning them the term ancient asexuals. We won't make a joke about our parents. Alan Tunnicliffe of the University of Cambridge and his colleagues examined genes associated with surviving dry spells, or what's technically called desiccation tolerance, in these bdelloid rotifers. And Alan Tunnicliffe and co. found two copies for a gene called the LEA or LEA gene. These genes are known to preserve enzymes during the drying spell in many different organisms. Now, what's getting interesting here is that the sequences of these LEA genes differed by about 13%, which is greater than the allele differences in sexual animals. And alleles, again, going back to Biology 101, are different copies of the same gene. For example, one allele can give you blue eyes, another can give you brown. Researchers also localized these LEA genes to different chromosomes, which would be expected of alleles from the same gene, and therefore also expected in former alleles. So basically what they're saying is these LEA genes are set up to look exactly like they once were alleles of the same gene that have gone on to become so different from each other that they are now actually distinct genes. The two genes each provide different protective benefits during these dry spells. One LEA gene protects proteins from clumping together. The other seems to protect the cell membrane from leakage and loss of fluid. So this goes on to support the idea that these were former alleles that accumulated enough mutations to actually become separate genes, which in an asexual animal is possible because of the lack of sexual genetic recombination. Because alleles become homogenized during recombination in sexual organisms, and the authors say that then asexual reproduction could be an evolutionary mechanism for the generation of genetic diversity through this splitting of alleles into new genes phenomenon. Of course, diversity is generated through sexual genetic recombination, so kind of splitting hairs a little bit here. And in fact, Roger Butlin at the University of Sheffield says that additional genes are not necessarily a straightforward solution to being asexual because, of course, if you get a bad mutation, you are still stuck with it. However, this seems to be a coup for asexual organisms and indeed an interesting new mechanism for the creation of new genes, although it seems, on the whole, still to be less fun than sexual reproduction. How's your handshake? Is it pretty strong? If you're a guy, your handshake grip strength can actually say a lot about you as a mate. So ladies, pay attention, or gentlemen, as your orientation may be, when you next meet someone who you're romantically interested in. There is a paper published in 2007 in Evolution and Human Behavior, Volume 28, Mind, by Gallup, White, and Gallup, Jr., that tested whether hand grip strength predicted sexual behavior, body morphology, and aggression in male college students. Now, hand grip strength is associated with various different things. For example, in elderly men with a high hand grip strength, they're on average at a lesser risk for disability and joint impairment. They also tend to live longer than those men with low hand grip strength. Hand grip strength is also positively associated with bone mineral density, protein loss in surgical patients, and muscle mass. It also varies as a function of developmental factors, including nutrition, exercise, and health, and actually is fairly heritable. In other words, if you have a high or low hand grip strength, your offspring will inherit that same strength from you with a coefficient of 0.65, so 65% likely. Basically, hand grip strength, if you have a really strong grip, it suggests that you're a strong person. And so what these researchers found was that in this particular study, hand grip strength was correlated with shoulder-to-hip ratio, which is a measure of healthy male body morphology, aggressive behavior, age at first sexual intercourse, and promiscuity in males but not in females. Hand grip strength appears to be an honest signal for genetic quality in males. So basically, if you have a strong grip, you are a fitter male, you'll probably have sex at an earlier age, you'll probably be more aggressive and more promiscuous. So I guess, ladies, it's a trade-off. If you want a fit mate who cheats and gets into fights, or if you maybe want someone with a slightly more genteel hand grip who may stick around and behave a bit more civilized. But there you have it. And if you want to fake being a particularly fit mate, guys, just make sure that you squeeze really hard when you meet people. Can you judge a man's sperm by his cover? Does male attractiveness tell us anything about semen quality? Peters, Rhodes, and Simmons recently published a paper in the Journal of Evolutionary Biology, Volume 21, where they went to look to see whether this was actually true. Does attractiveness in men provide clues to semen quality was the title of their paper. This was based on a previous study of Spanish men that reported that facial attractiveness was positively associated with semen quality. quality. So what Peters and company endeavored to do in their study was to determine whether this effect was widespread by studying a large sample of Australian men no older than 35 years, basically college-aged. And they looked at three different components of attractiveness. They defined as masculinity, averageness, and symmetry. I'll talk a bit about those later. Each male participant was photographed for both the body and face and asked to provide a semen sample that was analyzed for sperm morphology, motility, or ability to swim, and concentration. And these were evaluated according to the World Health Organization standards for healthy sperm. Yes, they do exist. The idea that there are visual cues that women can use or females can use to essentially screen good mates from less good mates is an idea that's been around for quite a while. And in non-human animals, for example, the red deer, there's evidence for this. In fact, males with larger antlers produce sperm with greater swimming velocity. And in a completely different group of vertebrates, this time fish, guppy males with greater areas of orange pigmentation produce faster swimming sperm of greater viability. So this idea that human females may be able to screen good from bad mates using visual cues is not completely out of left field. The traits that these authors used here were masculinity, which were characterized by a large jaw and a prominent brow ridge and cheekbones. They used asymmetry, which arises from deviations from perfect symmetry in bilateral traits. Basically, one side of the body should be identical to the other, should be a reflection. And average faces and bodies were determined by the mean of trait values for that population. Basically, if you're high in averageness, you're low in distinctiveness, hence you don't stick out in a crowd. And the idea of looking at symmetry and averageness were incorporated because these two traits are thought to reflect a person's ability to cope with environmental and genetic stresses throughout their development. Essentially, if you grow up symmetrical and average, despite any kind of disturbances or problems during your development, you're meant to be fitter as a mate because you've been able to withstand the onslaught of anything that might throw off your development and make you abnormal and have bad genes. The authors got different groups of women to evaluate the photographs of the men's faces and bodies, and this included women who were in different phases of the menstrual cycle. It's been shown that women who are in the fertile phase of their cycle have different preferences for males than women who are in the infertile phase. For example, when women are fertile, they tend to prefer more masculine-looking men, which is the opposite to women who are in the infertile phase of the cycle. They tend to prefer males who are more feminized in their appearance. The upshot of this study was that the authors found no associations between attractiveness and semen quality, even when women rated attractiveness at the fertile point of their menstrual cycle, when male fertility might be expected to be of the greatest importance. So this study suggests that visual attractiveness does not provide women with cues to male reproductive potential. However, several studies suggest that olfactory cues, or a sense of smell, may be important in signaling mate quality. For example, body odor provides cues to genes associated with immune function, such that women are attracted to the smell of men with genes dissimilar to their own. So basically, if you are with a long-term partner, see if you guys get sick at the same time, or if you tend to get sick from the same illness, or whether or not a cold that takes down your partner doesn't take you down, and vice versa. Because apparently that's what you're meant to be selecting for with these olfactory cues. Furthermore, women show a preference for the scent of men with relatively low body asymmetry. So going back to this idea that you develop a very symmetrical way that reflects your genetic fitness. And they particularly prefer body symmetry when they're at the fertile point of their menstrual cycle. And that's the scent of men, not the actual symmetry itself, but the smell of men who are symmetrical. So there you go. If you want to judge a mate, smell him. Don't look at him. Which I guess kind of bodes well for online dating. Because you can meet and then smell. And you may not like how he looks, but that's okay, because the smell is probably going to tell you more. Anyway, this is Air with Sexy Boy.
Now, did I or did I not do vaginal juices?
Yes, sir.
Yes, sir.
Name two ways of getting them flowing, Watson.
Rubbing the clitoris, sir.
What's wrong with a kiss, boy? Why not start her off with a nice kiss? You don't have to go leaping straight for the clitoris like a bullet again. Give her a kiss, boy.
Suck the nipple, sir.
Good. Well done, Weimer.
Striking the thigh, sir.
Yes, sir. I suppose so.
Not in the neck.
Yes, good. Nibbling the earlobe, kneading the buttocks, and so on and so forth. So we have all these possibilities before we stampede towards the clitoris.
On March 15th, Engineers Without Borders are hosting Bridging the Gap, a citywide conference on issues of global poverty and the role of society, technology, and the individual.
The conference will bring together members of a community, engineers and non-engineers alike, who share an interest in making a difference.
Delegates will hear from community leaders and individuals with experience on human development projects in Canada and overseas. Through panel discussions and workshops, topics such as the root causes of poverty, corporate social responsibility, and fair trade will be covered.
The conference will close with a keynote address by the Honorable Lieutenant General Romeo Dallaire, author of Shake Hands with the Devil and former United Nations Force Commander in Rwanda.
This event is being hosted at the Empire Landmark Hotel in downtown Vancouver, located at 1400 Robson Street. Once again, the date is Saturday, March 15th, from 9 a.m. until 5 p.m. Tickets are available now at regular and student prices through Ticketmaster. For more information, please visit www.ewbmonth.ca.
Welcome back to My Science Project. This is the show about the science of love, attraction, and sex. At the top of the show, I talked about a couple of tidbits I would discuss with you. The first is when incest is actually best. Kissing cousins have more kin. This is a study that was reported in Scientific American earlier this month. A study analyzed more than 200 years of data to find that couples consisting of third cousins have the highest reproductive success. Scientists at Icelandic biotech company Decode Genetics say that when third and fourth cousins come together, they generally have scads of kids and grandkids relative to the rest of us. Records of more than 160,000 Icelandic couples with members born between the years 1800 and 1965 were included in this data set. A strength of this is that the Icelandic population is rather small and fairly socioeconomically as well as culturally homogeneous, so it minimizes those variables in a scientific research study. There's also little variation in family size and use of contraceptives and marriage practices. The scientists found that women born between 1800 and 1824 who mated with a third cousin had about 4 kids and 9 grandkids compared to women who merged with a splurge with someone no closer than an 8th cousin, in which case they had 3 kids and about 7 grandkids. Those proportions held up among women born more than one century later when couples were, on average, having fewer kids. Couples that were second cousins or more closely related, collective BRR, did not have as many kids. The most likely reason is probably that the offspring of such close relatives had shorter lifespans because of the inheritance of harmful genetic mutations. However, the third and fourth cousin mating probably succeeded more than more distant matings because mating with a relative might reduce a woman's chance of having a miscarriage caused by immunological incompatibility between a mother and her child. This incompatibility is less probable if the parents are closely related in that their blood makeup is more likely to match, hence lower likelihood of rejecting the baby. So I guess the trick is to get close enough so that you can minimize your incompatibility, but distant enough so that you're not amplifying any kind of funky, recessive, bad mutations. We talked earlier in the show about using visual cues to select or screen for a healthy mate. There's been science done on something called osculation, the scientific term for kissing, which may be one other way that we screen, consciously or unconsciously, for the best possible mate. At the end of January, Scientific American published an article about osculation. Apparently, kissing triggers a cascade of neural messages and chemicals that transmit all kinds of information, tactile sensations, sexual excitement, feelings of closeness and motivation, and, as we know from having experienced a great kiss, even a sense of euphoria. Of course, we also know that if a kiss goes bad, it can be the kiss of death, waka waka waka, to an otherwise promising relationship. So some scientists do believe that kissing evolved because it facilitates mate selection and involves a very complicated exchange of information. As I mentioned before, all these feelings, emotions, chemicals, including olfactory information. And it turns out that sense of smell can actually play a role in women's mate selection choice, particularly depending upon the phase of their menstrual cycle. Whether humans sense pheromones, or these chemical packets of smell info, is still controversial, but if pheromones do play a role in human courtship and procreation, then kissing could be an extremely effective way to pass this information from one person to the other. However, kissing is not necessarily a completely evolutionary essential, because of course many different types of animals actually don't kiss, or even neck. Although maybe heavy petting, and they still manage to produce plenty of offspring. Further to that, and something I did not even think about, not all humans kiss. In fact, up to 10% of humanity does not touch lips, according to human ethology pioneer Arenaus Abel Ibisfeld, now head of the Max Planck Society Film Archive of Human Ethology in Andechs, Germany. Other research published in 1992 suggests that some 650 million of us humans have not mastered the art of osculation. For those of us who do practice and enjoy kissing, the lips are actually among the most densely populated region of the human body, with more sensory neurons. As we kiss, these neurons, along with those in the tongue and mouth, send messages to the brain and body, triggering all kinds of emotional and physical reactions. Piece of trivia for your next cocktail party. Of the 12 or 13 cranial nerves that affect cerebral function, 5 are at work when we kiss. Kissing also boosts pulse and blood pressure, dilates the pupils, changes breathing patterns, and makes rational thought basically fly out the door. So scientists have clearly shown that, and hey, we've clearly shown ourselves in our own bedrooms of the nation that, and movie theaters and other places, that kissing clearly has significant emotional and physical effects, some of which may be involved in screening and mate choice, although the mechanisms for this seem as yet unidentified. This is Vancouver-based Children of the CPU with their song Analog Hearts.
I'm Peter Mansbridge, and you're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And you're also listening to My Science Project. I'm your host, Julia. If you'd like to get in touch with me or my co-host, Anne, if you've got suggestions for topics you'd like covered on the show, if you've got some feedback for us, and even if you've got science events of your own that you'd like us to promote on air, drop us an email at myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. myscienceprojectradio@yahoo.ca. I have some science events to tell you about for the next little while. February and March seem to be very popular for scheduling scientific-oriented things. Maybe it has something to do with capitalizing on the lack of other activities there are to do when it's the middle of winter and everyone's slightly depressed. But here's something that will lift your spirits, no doubt. It is the monthly Café Scientifique. Yes, that's right, an event that Anne is very heavily involved in co-organizing, and I chip in now and again when I can. Café Sci for this month happens Tuesday, February 26th at 7:30 p.m. at the Railway Club, located, of course, at Seymour and Dunsmuir Streets downtown. This month's Café Sci presents Dr. Bob Hancock of UBC's Department of Microbiology and Immunology. And Dr. Hancock is going to talk about antibiotic resistance, why you should be concerned. Of course, Café Sci is totally free and totally open. If you're a scientist, grab a non-scientist friend, bring them along. If you are not a scientist yourself, fantastic. Come on down, join Anne and Jamie and everyone else down there, including Dr. Bob Hancock, for some beer and coffee and drinks and some good food. It should be a good night. I'm sorry, I am one province over and we'll miss it. Another event happening in early March is the Squist XX evening. This is an event that Anne promoted on her last show, and I will give it some due here as well. It's Squist's annual networking event to find out how amazing women are making careers in science and technology. The evening is for all women in undergraduate science, engineering, and technology, and it happens on Tuesday, March 4th at Science World from 5:30 p.m. Registration starts at 5:15, followed by a panel discussion, pizza and networking, and lastly, the Omnimax film Dinosaurs Alive. All of this is covered by the $12 entrance fee, which is not too shabby at all. I did attend one of these events in the past, and it was really, really fun and really informative, so I would recommend it if you are looking for your path in science and technology as a career, and I happen to be female, to pre-register. Squist asks all registrants to make themselves known by February 29th. That is the pre-registration deadline. And to do this, you can call Science World at 604-443-7551. Or you can email J. Scott, Scott with a double T at the end, J. Scott, at scienceworld.bc.ca. I'm sure if you go to the Squist website, scwist.ca, they also will have registration info for you on their website. Lastly, UBC is holding their annual Celebrate Research Week from March 4th to 15th at both of their Vancouver and Okanagan campuses. And at the Vancouver campus, in particular, the UBC Department of Mechanical Engineering is holding a free open house on Friday, March 14th. The day runs from 10 in the morning till 8 in the evening. It will feature unique tours of research labs, short talks on a variety of topics, including clean energy research, robotics, which is warmly thought of around these My Science Project parts, and biomechanical engineering, as well as other events. The invitation goes out to the general public, as well as school and community groups. If you'd like more information, you can visit www.mech.ubc.ca. That's M-E-C-H, mech.ubc.ca. Or you can email Jennifer Pelletier, who I presume is a organizer, at jennifer@mech.ubc.ca, or call her 827-4090. The mech.ubc.ca website, there is also a link to Jen Pelletier's contact info. If you'd like to find out more about Celebrate Research Week in general, including their events calendar, many of which are free and definitely open to the public, visit www.celebrateresearch.ubc.ca. That's it for this show on the Science Live. Anne is on in 2 weeks' time from now. Darren is up next with stereoscopic readout. And I will leave you with this question offered by Lou Donaldson. Who's making Live?